Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
My name is John Bruce. I'm here to put my experience about Vietnam on tape. Well, it started back on August 15th, 1968, when I received my draft notice to be inducted into the armed forces. Once I reported to the induction center, we received our orders to move out to Fort Leonard, Missouri, which is in the eastern part of Missouri. While there, we trained for at least 16 weeks of constantly training. We had PT, physical training, we had weapons, qualifications, we had map reading, we had grenade training, we had chemical warfare training. This was all in about a 16-week span. Once you graduated, you received your orders. Some went directly home because the schools were not ready to accept any recruits. I received my orders to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I qualified to be an artilleryman, which I trained for about 8 weeks in field artillery, specializing in a 105 howitzer, which is a cannon. Once that training was done, in the latter part of December of 1968, I was sent home for a 30-day leave. My destination was Vietnam. While home, I married my childhood sweetheart. Matter of fact, January 4th, 1969. Shortly after that, I received my orders to report to San Francisco. Once there, we was in a holding area for a couple weeks. Then we were shipped out to Vietnam. I remember arriving in Vietnam. Once I got off the plane, the country just stunk. I mean, it just literally stunk. It had a foul odor, something I've never smelled before. Well, once I got off the plane, we was instructed to go to another training site. This training site in Vietnam was where they train you again, basically for combat. And what's so funny about it, once I received my training, they gave us new rifles. They called M16s. Back in the state, I trained on M14. So I couldn't, this M16 you had to get familiarized with. It was an automatic weapon. I've never seen one before, never heard of one. So we trained about 4 to 5 days. Then we assigned to different units. I was assigned to the 82nd Division, 2nd and 321st Field Artillery, which was 3rd Brigade. Once I received my orders, we were bused to our designated units. I don't know the exact time that I arrived to my unit, but my assignment was Bravo Battery. See, each each battery, there's three batteries, A, B, and C. Mine was B. I arrived there, my job was for, I don't know, a couple months or so, I was what they call a cannon cocker. Now what that is someone to handle ammo, because I was new on the block, new kid on the block. And once I worked at that for a while, I moved up to a loader, which I would load the big shells into the breech and move out of the way, because the recoil of that gun will break your legs in two. So you had to know how to do that. Well, I did this for a while, maybe, I don't know, a couple months. So I knew my assistant gunner, which I became friends with. His name was Pineapple. He was Hawaiian, from Hawaii. And I knew he was rotating out to go back home. So I kind of took it on myself to go over and become the assistant gunner. See, there actually there's about 4 to 5 primary positions on a 105 howitzer. You have your section chief, who's in charge. You have your gunner, who gets all this numbers or whatever you want to call it for the gun, the direction. He gets that from the FCC, the Forward Control Center, and they hand it down to the section chief, which is the E6, the gunner is E5, and then the gunner will talk to the assistant gunner and give him number, which is called a quadrant. What that is, the elevation. That was my job. Once I received my quadrant, the three numbers, my job was to pull the lanyard, which like a trigger with a string on it. So that was my job for a while. And the first night, if I can recall, the first night I became a full-fledged assistant gunner, we had a fire mission. See, artillerymen are like firemen. You sleep with your clothes on, because you don't never know when you gotta get up in the middle of the night and man the guns. There's 6 guns to a battery. I believe my section was 4. And each gun had a name. Ours was ball constrictor, because it strikes. Well, we had this fire mission, I don't know, probably around 2,200 hours, somewhere in that, which is 10 o'clock. So we had a fire mission. Our infantry got into a small skirmish with either the Viet Cong or the NVA. That's the North Vietnamese Army. Regulars. I can remember that night that I actually become an assistant gunner, my first fire mission. But we were firing. So on the horizon, there was a Chinook CH-47, which is a helicopter, troop carrier. And it flew right into our path. Now, I don't know which guns did it. Mine, gun, I don't know. To this day, I still don't know. We couldn't check fire. Check fire means stop quick. We couldn't do that. It was too late. All I know is one of the rounds hit that big old Chinook helicopter. It was a great big ball of orange fire. I was shocked. There were some American soldiers on there. I don't know the exact count that we killed. And to this day, I still can see that blown CH-47 helicopter flying in our path. Well, that bothered me. It really bothered me. I said, man. But the section chief came over and said, look, this is war. Things are gonna happen in war. So his word to me was, suck it up and let's get our job done. But still was in the back of my mind. That's just one occasion that I witnessed. Well, somewhere maybe about a, I don't know, shortly right after that, could have been a 2 or 3 weeks, could have been a month, I don't recall. We had another fire mission. This was hot and heavy. Infantry got overran. We could see the tracer rounds. We could hear the sounds. So they called us in. Oh, I guess we were probably about, I don't know, 4 miles. Them guns shoot 7 miles. And we had two other surrounding batteries within our distance. So we got involved in it. We fired. We fired so much that the tubes on our guns got red hot. We had to pull water down them. Because we didn't, if we put a round in that hot breech, the gun could blow up and kill all of us. So we had to pull water down. During the midst of the battle, we could hear the screams, the hollering. All hell broke loose. They brought in Puff the Mighty Dragon. They brought in Spooky. They brought in Huey gunships. They brought in Phantoms. I'm telling you, it was a night I'll never forget, of the hollering, the screaming, the crying. It was a horrible sound. And I kept on firing. I tried not to let that bother me because I knew they was getting overrun. This lasted for a little, maybe about 23, 24 straight hours. The temperature was about 115 degrees. Now I weighed probably about 125, but when I got through with that, I swear I weighed about 110. No rest, just firing at will. There was no command, they just said fire at will. We fired. You could smell the powder, gunpowder. I sure could believe to this day that I could smell burning flesh. That's how close we were. It was something that looked like out of Star Wars movie. Tracer rounds, and we set up on kind of a hill, and we could see down in there. It was no pretty sight. There was no pretty sound. Jesus. On both sides you could hear. Both sides. They finally called ceasefire sometime the next morning. Exhausted, tired. I don't know if I was scared or not. Couldn't stand up. My whole section was wore down. We never recovered after that incident. I know I didn't. That's one of the other battles that I was in. I mean, I was traumatized. And to this day, I'm still traumatized behind it. Well, later on after that, I was laying in my bunker. I heard this sound, like a big explosion. It wasn't too far from our position. So the section chief came in and said, I need volunteers. And I raised my hand, I don't know why. I thought maybe we going to back to the rear somewhere or to the PX. So they loaded us up on trucks. And at that time, I acquired an M79 grenade launcher. It looks like a broken shotgun that you break down. Big old shells will go in it. And so I inherited that from one of the guys that rotating back to the States. So I come in, I got on the truck as ordered, jumped. We went about, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles somewhere. And we entered this small village. We jumped off the truck. We set up perimeter because what happened was one of our fighter pilots got shot down, and we had to go in there and try to get him out of there. It looks like a peaceful village at that time. So we ought to set our perimeter. That means just go in, do a sweep, see if anything's in there that shouldn't be in there, like the Viet Cong or NBA. Because they always wanted to take a prisoner of war. Well, we did this. And then the infantry were close by and they came in. And we secured the area. They go in and try to find the pilot. Well, I believe they got the pilot out of there because the jet crashed into the village. Now, what I'm going to tell you is one of the worst things I ever seen in my life. Everything was secured. We were ordered to go in to help remove dead bodies where the crash had killed people and the jet fuel had spilled on some of the people. These people were burnt beyond recognition. I'm talking about babies, small children, adults, old and new, old and young. We had to put a scarf around our nose and our mouth. So once we did this, I could see those dead bodies today. They're kind of, like a bunch of pus. And they smelled like burnt bacon. We had to take these bodies and shovels and put them in a big hole. Dig a hole and put all these. Some of them you couldn't even shovel up, like ashes, just slime. I mean, bodies, mass, just, You put in shovels and some of them slide off the shovel. I threw up. I just kept throwing up. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe how a human body could be this. I just couldn't believe how this human body looked. The destruction from the crash of the jet and the jet fuel, I believe it was JP-8 or 9, burnt the village up. We stayed there maybe, 3 to 4 hours, sick. Most of us got sick. I wouldn't eat for a while. It took me a long time to eat. I could see all this. And I had to come to grips with myself. I remember what my second sergeant said. This is war. You'll see everything. Things you've never seen before in your life. Things you will never see again if you live through it. So, I went on back. We stayed there for a while. All this was in the back of my mind. Couldn't sleep at night. We had a little more fire missions, that they're called, skirmishes or whatnot. So, I had to volunteer again. Why was I volunteering so much? This time, it was kind of an easy job, so they explained to us. We had to help one of the infantry. They were moving their location, so we had to truck up into these mountains and pull them out and move some of their supply to a different location. Well, while traveling to these mountains, I ran into three soldiers from Detroit, I believe, or the Detroit area. And they was in minesweeping detail, and I talked to them. We talked to them. So anyway, so we all took out, loaded. They was in the front vehicle, had a driver and three or four of them in it. So these three gentlemen got out to sweep the roads. We was in the back. I can't recall their names. They told me, I think one of them named Smitty. Anyway, like I said, it was a big explosion. So we stopped. We normally you're supposed to keep going, but we didn't know if the roads were still full of mines or not. You were trained to keep driving, but we didn't at particular time. So I got out, see what was going on. So I seen these three guys. Well, there was another sight I seen. Of these three gentlemen, two of them were blown up and landed to my immediate left in a ditch. I seen them. Wasn't nothing left of them. They was all blowed apart. Couldn't even recognize them. So then I seen Smitty, I believe his name. I seen him. He was still half alive. He was to the right. And I looked at Smitty. A lot of them looked at Smitty. And all he could say was, or ask, he said, how did my buddies, did they make it? And they told him, no, they didn't make it. So Smitty kind of, I believe he was in shock, because he looked at his right arm, he held it up, his skin was hanging off, bleeding, half gone. His left arm was blown completely off. As he looked down to his midsection, his stomach, all that was blown out, wasn't nothing there. And he kind of looked down and he laid his head back and died. I just met these guys. Seemed like I knew them all my life. That was another thing I went through. I want to get the hell out of here. Why am I here? So then we went on. We proceeded, got to our location where they were. And they put us in bunkers. I'm laying there in the bunk. Bunkers are so dark, you don't know what's in there at night. We stayed up there, I think, a couple of days. And something jumped on my chin. I didn't know it was a Viet Cong. I didn't know. We were fighting. I rode all my bunk. We were fighting. I had him. I stumbled out the front door. I only had one door. And I was rolling around. And it was daylight. I didn't know it was daylight till I got out. And then when I got through, I felt bad. One of the soldiers had a pet monkey, spider monkey, and I choked it to death. He was on a chain. I didn't know. And I apologized to the soldier, but he couldn't take it. He didn't. And he just don't understand what I went through from my point of view. The next night, I recall, I was in a bunker again. And I was so tired that when I woke up the next morning, they had a rocket attack. Trucks all blowed up, smoking. I didn't know it until I asked them, what happened? I said, man, we had a rocket attack. I slept through it. Never heard. I slept through a rocket attack. Trucks were blowed up. Ours wasn't. So we finally got them situated, moved back. Got back to our location. We're probably 40, 50 miles, maybe 60 miles away. We got back to our location, stayed there for a while. You know, time was getting short. I probably had 3 months left in the country. I didn't know at that time. So we packed up and moved further into the jungles. Matter of fact, we moved closer to one of the rivers. Now, I don't know the name of the river. I knew it out in the jungle. So once there, we was there for, I don't know, a couple weeks, maybe three, I don't know. And I know it's October. I do know it's October 69. And I'll tell you why in a minute. So we got into another battle. Mortars came in on us. We were sitting around talking, just having general conversation about what we're going to do when we get home and things of that nature. So anyway, I mean, we were getting hammered by mortars. So we had a fire mission once again. And then we fired. One of the mortar rounds exploded by our gun, and one of the shrapnel hit me in the knee and kind of cut my knee. It was bleeding a little bit. And the section sergeant said, let me see it. I looked at, he looked at it and said, I'm gonna put you in for a Purple Heart. I said, no, I don't want no Purple Heart. I said, you know, I said, Sarge, all I want to do is go home. I said, I don't want no Purple Heart. But I was thinking Purple Hearts, necessarily, I knew about it. I thought Purple Hearts, you don't even see Purple Hearts, you get killed. I didn't want none, I wasn't dead. So anyway, during this battle after that, this lieutenant came out. I mean, he came out with a helmet on, flak jacket, pistol. I mean, he looked like a regular sad sack. Pistol belt too big, helmet too big, glasses. He kind of reminded you of Captain Binghamton on the old McHale Navy show. So he loads crawl over there and talk, and his words were, the father of a 7-pound, 6-ounce girl with your front center. We fine. Now, I'm not paying attention. He said it again. Well, the father of a 7-pound, 6-ounce girl front center. And we kept on firing. So then he said, Corporal Bruce. I was Corporal at that time. He come over to me. You the father of a 7-pound, 6-ounce girl. And I stood there and looked at him in the fire mission. I wanted to knock him out. Now, I'm in a fire mission. Things could happen. I'm thinking about my daughter and get my men killed. Or get myself killed. Because of what he said. I don't think that was the time to tell me that. I mean, I don't think he had a clue what he was saying or what he was doing. So anyway, once that was over with, it didn't hit me yet. Till I don't know, shortly after that hit me that I had a daughter. And oh man, I got a daughter. Great. So anyway, so that. And then they move us back to our primary location that we were when I first got there. They trucked us back, moved the guns back. And I was laying on the bunk. This, you know, because my daughter, what I said, my daughter born October 9th, 1969. That was my last battle. And that's the one I can recall. So like I said, we moved back to our permanent position, our primary position we were when I first got to Vietnam. And I was laying on my bunk. Sergeant came in, a new section chief, all the other guys had rotated out. He said, you're going home. I said, what do you mean we're going home? He said, we're going home. Nixon pulling out the 82nd Airborne, 3rd Brigade. We jumped up on, oh man, we was happy. We was happy, cheering. And so we still have a few skirmishes in between that. So sometime in November, they sent us back to the main headquarters to turn in all our equipment. All our equipment. So we turned it back, sitting back, relaxing, getting ready to be processed out, trying to turn our uniforms in. We had a second lieutenant. He came in, everybody sitting at the bar, kind of celebrating those that can go home and celebrating those that didn't make it home that we knew. He wanted to go out on patrol, and we couldn't believe what he was asking. So there was some of them said, yeah, we'll go out on patrol with you, lieutenant. Now, this is like 11 o'clock at night. Now, why would you want to go out on patrol? They wasn't bothering us. The enemy wasn't bothering us. He wanted to make a name for himself. He went out. I don't know how many men. I know I didn't go. But we found out the next day that the Viet Cong come up underground on them and wiped them out. And these guys getting ready to go home. I couldn't believe it. You know, I didn't have too much to do with second lieutenants or any lieutenant after that. All my military career was. Well, I got home in November 1969. And I got to thinking about that war. You know, everybody made money off that war. but the GI. All your beer, breweries, your distilled manufacturer, like whiskey, whatever. You had all your soft drink companies. You had your toy company. You had politicians, food vendors. Everybody was making money off this war. Everybody. But the, like I said, the GI. We got hazard duty pay, and that was taken away once you got back from the States. It was a profit war for the United States. And to this day, I know we lost that war. They'll deny it. You know, things happen over there. Just like body count. Let me explain to you what a body count is to them. I guess with all the protesting in the United States and about the war, wanting to bring the boys home and everything, it was a kind of a sad ordeal. You draft a 17-year-old kid, 18-year-old kid, put him in a harm's way, put him in the middle of a jungle, put him in somewhere he never knew, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and tell him to fight. You train him to be a killing machine. That's all he knows over there. That's all he knows is killing. You know, some of the bureaucrats back home were getting pacified because, let me tell you what a body count over there is. They can go out and blow up one enemy soldier. If his arm is still attached with his hand, the four fingers and a thumb count as five bodies. That's the way they did their body count. Reason being because, like I said, they had to pacify everybody back in the United States like we were doing our job. We were getting our ass kicked. We was getting our ass kicked at random. So you can't go into somebody else's country, their backyard, and try to beat them at it. There's no way. We didn't know too much about jungle warfare. Nobody knew about jungle warfare. Hardly. We weren't trained for that until they later on, you know, when we got drafted, they started training because of a different type of war. You know, they're talking about rules of a war. Well, the Geneva Convention sets rules for a war. Don't believe that happened. You are not supposed to mutilate a body, which happened. You weren't supposed to do anything to those bodies according to Geneva Convention. You know, I talked to some infantry guys that was out there at the time I was over there, and they were telling the stories like they find a Viet Cong, an NVA soldier, and they would capture him. And to get rid of him, what they would do was they would tie a rope on his legs, lift him up in a Huey helicopter, have him dangling down this rope from the feet down and drive down through trees and stuff. And when they get through, it's a leg on this rope. That's all that's left. There's some horror stories went around over there. There have been incidents when I talked to some of the infantry guys, because they knew they was out in the jungle. Some of these guys were traumatized. Or they could go down a banana grove somewhere in there, or maybe a fence there, and they see a body on the fence split in two, right, with a machete hanging up there, where the enemy has killed some of the Vietnamese. Now, don't think the United States was innocent over there. And I'm just going to tell you, they may not like this, but I'm just going to tell you, some of them infantry guys went out, and I know it's true fact because this is my story. They went out and they raped these women. They 8-9-year-old girl, they raped them, killed them. You know, that's the heart of the war. You know, They sit and tell, they was telling us a lot of things that went on. Some that they couldn't stop some of the soldiers because their rank prevented them from stopping things like this. You know, you raping a little 7-8 year old girl. What can a 7-8 year old girl do to you? Nothing. So don't think the United States was innocent in that war. I'm sure it happened on the other side too, the Viet Cong. But the way I look at it, when they told me this, I said, man, you know, that could be my daughter these guys are doing it to. I mean, it's so, war is so freely open over that you can do what you want, basically. If you see a Vietnamese walking down the street, you can shoot them and get away with it. I mean, everything went in that war. They did everything. There's some things I probably don't know that they did. And like I said, this is what I witnessed. These are not tales, not talk, they're not made up. Not by a long shot. And you know, even one of the first 17-year-olds that actually was killed in Vietnam, I went to junior high with him in Olathe, Kansas. He went in September of 65. He got killed October of 1965. He was 17 years old. But what he did, his mom signed his papers and said he was 18. Now, he was a good friend of mine. And I still think about him today. Little did I know that he was one of the first 17-year-olds to get killed. A lot of them got killed over there. But you take, like I said earlier, you take a 18-year-old kid off the street, straight out of high school, graduated, and put him in a war. A war he'll never see again or witness. You know? Sure. I received numerous awards while I was in Vietnam. I wasn't trying to get them, like the Bronze Star. That's just one of them. I got about 4 or 5 more from the Vietnam War. Unit Citation, Presidential Citation Award, Civil Action Award, Cross of Gallantry Award. I got those. Those awards don't mean nothing to me. You know, today, you know, some of my comrades said, you know, you're a war hero. No, I was not a war hero. I survived. By the grace of God, believing in Jesus Christ. He took care of me because some of them things I didn't think I was getting out of. 58,000 gave their life. Those are your real heroes. The ones that sacrifice their lives for a foreign country that we knew nothing about, I knew nothing about, never heard of it. Didn't even know what direction it was in. Those are your real heroes. Your POWs that got captured, those are your real heroes. I don't consider myself a hero, and I never will. And I'm still going through this PTSD. At nights, I still get up screaming and hollering. If I hear a helicopter, one of the worst holidays that I hate is 4th of July. It brings back memories, bad memories. There's been some time I can sit outside my patio, and I can hear helicopters. At that time, back in the day, in Vietnam, you could tell what helicopter was what. Your Hueys, the Chinooks, you knew them at night. You could knew who they were because they flew constantly all hours of the night. Now, I couldn't tell the jets, but I could tell them helicopters. And like I said, this war traumatized me and a lot of other vets. And like I said, we developed what they call PTSD, post-traumatic disorder. I never knew I would graduate from high school, be involved in a war like that to this day. Well, you know, they said time heals everything. Not that, because I know some of the World War II guys, Korean Wars, they went through what we went through. But it wasn't called PTSD then. I don't know, it's called shell shock, battle fatigue. I don't know what else they called it. And they finally diagnosed it with PTSD. So I have to deal with PTSD the rest of my life. Well, every now and then it takes a toll on my wife. That's the way I act. You got to keep moving to not think about it. That's why I stay busy. I have to stay busy because if I sit down, and sometimes I'll sit down and get to thinking about, man, start having flashbacks, especially when I hear a helicopter fly over. I really start having flashbacks. Sometimes I have dreams about it. There's been an incident at one time I got in the middle of the night and I thought my wife would enter me and hit her. And she didn't understand until later on she found out what I was going through. I mean, that hurts inside. And I almost took my wife out because of some war that never should have took place. You know, the bottom line is, why were we there? Nobody knows why we was there. It was a profit war, for like I said earlier, for all the big manufacturing companies. And I think that's the only way the United States can survive, that they have a war. To this day, I believe any president in office got to have a war for the sake of the economy. I well believe that. You know, 2019, May 15th to be exact, I had the pleasure and honor to board a plane and fly to Washington, D.C. It's called an honor flight. And I got to view all the different monuments out there. Or what we call statues or whatever. World War II, the Korean, and the Vietnam War. I seen the wall and I looked for my buddy. He was there. But see, I seen a wall previous to that. Perryville, Missouri. Which last year they built a wall. Perryville, Missouri, a little way, 60 miles outside of St. Louis. One of the guys that served Vietnam donated his land and they got a replica of the wall, identical. So they had all the names put on the wall. There I seen James Calvin Ward, that's what I'm talking about. My son drove me down and he took me down there. I let him view the wall, and I had the pleasure, they had a dedication, I had the pleasure to get to lay the reef. So they asked me to lay the reef for all the Vietnam vets, and I thought that was an honor. It was emotional for me, because you could see the tears in my eye. And, you know, while making the trip, my son asked me, what did I do, my youngest son, and I told him, he just looked at me, because he was driving. He said, Dad, I never had no idea that's what you did. I said, yeah, because I never talked about it. He said, man, Dad, I didn't know you went through that. I said, yeah, I went through it. I definitely went through it, son. That's all I can say. And I told him something to think. He said, man. And he thought that was the greatest thing he seen when he went to the wall with me. And so, you know, I thought maybe he was traumatized. but he wasn't. But you know, Vietnam leaves a bad taste in your mouth. You know, it was a war that, like I said earlier, we should have never gotten involved in that war. And from the way I understand today, it never was declared a war. It was just a conflict. To me, war is war. I don't know if it's a conflict or what, but that's... And in closing, I just want to say that I might do it again if I was younger. I don't know. You know, because like I said, I was drafted. And the only ones that didn't get drafted was some of the rich. Some of the rich guys didn't get drafted because they ran their tail to Canada because they were cowards. You know, I still say they're cowards. Those that ran to Canada to avoid the Vietnam War, they were cowards. That's all I can say. Big time. They ought to be ashamed of themselves. We had to go, but they didn't. Their daddies and mama paid them out. Oh, you go to Canada. You don't have to go to the war. That's not your war. Well, we figured it wasn't our war either. Into some foreign country for some foreign people that we ain't knew nothing about. Well, anyway, that's my story. My name is John Bruce. I served with the 3rd Brigade, 82nd Airborne, Vietnam, 2nd 321st Field Artillery, Bravo Battery, from January 1969 through November 1969. And that is my story. And you know, you have to live it to see it. And I've seen my share of killing. That's why today I try not to get upset with no one. So anyway, that's my story from the Vietnam War. Thank you.